Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Kansas City is home to an underground business complex called the Subtropolis. Its address is 8300 Northeast Underground Drive. An annual groundhog run hosted by the complex has people running 5 and 10K races, all underground, in a space with geothermal properties ensuring perfect weather on race day. There's an extensive network of tunnels, caves, and mines underground in Kansas City, and the Subtropolis is just one part of it. So where did this labyrinth come from, and how has it been used? To learn more about the history of our city's underground spaces, we've invited KCUR's resident historian Monroe Dodd to the studio. Hi, Monroe.
Good morning, Gina.
What interests you about Kansas City's caves and tunnels and underground complexes?
I think I'm fascinated the way anyone is with the idea of something you can't see at first. People love to talk about, were there mystery tunnels in which mobsters did this or gang bosses did that?
Were there?
Is there a whole world? Never been really shown to be the case. But people love it anyway. And so to think of an entire underground city, it's almost like the movie Metropolis. It's fantastic. It plays with imagination.
It sure does. What have been some of the historic uses of these spaces?
Storage is a big thing because there's a pretty constant temperature and pretty constant humidity for a lot of people. Simply space, lots of space, inexpensive. You don't, for instance, have to build a floor, walls, or a ceiling. You just move in if you're a company. Some companies even have needed a stable ground to devise carefully surveying instruments and other stuff. A guy named Brunson did this a long time ago. Dr. Hassan can talk more about this, but he needed something stable, and the underground was stable. The underground network is just millions and millions of square feet across the Kansas City metro area are dedicated to this because of our geological structure, I suppose. But it speaks to the fact of part of Kansas City's driving forces over the years has been to bring stuff in, goods, and then distribute them from this central point to the rest of the country. That happens a lot underground.
So was the availability of that resource, this underground space, part of how that became an industry here? Or did the fact that that industry is here lead us to create these underground spaces?
Oh, I think it's the underground space, the possibility limestone was mined, quarried out of stuff, and look, we've got this big room left over, and look how nice it is in here, except you don't get much of a view. I think that came first.
Well, we're also joined by Syed Hassan. He's a professor of geosciences at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Professor Hassan, where did this labyrinth come from? What exactly is it geologically?
Well, glad to be here. Thank you. Kansas City has been blessed, I would say, with a very favorable geology. The rocks that we see around in the road carts and bluffs and all over is really very old, geologically speaking, about 300 million years old. And it is actually an alternating series of limestone and shale. They are sandwiched in between. And the favorable aspects about the geology is that these limestone beds are horizontal. The rocks could be anywhere from flat level to upright, depending upon the past geological history of the area. So we didn't have much what we call tectonic movements, which causes the rock to be pushed up and thrust over and all that kind of thing.
So tectonic movements, that's when, you know, the rock layers kind of butt up against each other.
Butt up against each other, they press against each other, and they keep on building stress until a point come when the stress exceeds the strength and the rock snaps, you have earthquake. That's what is happening in California and other places. So we didn't have that kind of tectonic movements in the area when these rocks were formed. So the rocks are horizontal. And then I said that there are layers of shale and limestone sandwiched in between. Now, whenever you're trying to do anything underground, you want to have, first of all, a very flat level to go and move. If it is inclined, that creates problem. So that was one favorable thing. And then the good quality limestone that was mentioned, Monroe mentioned that it was being extracted basically for cement making. Some of the layers of limestones are very pure chemically. And they are excellent.
That's just, that happens to occur here in a very pure state?
Right. Some layers, not all of the limestone that we see. One of those limestones is called Bethany Fall limestone. That's the geological name. Now, that limestone is absolutely pure. It's 95% calcium carbonate, which is the main stuff we are looking for manufacturing cement. So that prompted the excavation. And also, limestones, these have got very high strength, so they can be used for building. In the olden days, these slabs of rocks were the main structural member of the buildings. Later on, they were replaced with Portland cement. So that the rocks had a lot of strength, so it was used for that purpose. So there was extensive mining going on.
In what time period are we talking about?
It started, serious mining started from the later part of the 19th century, 1870s and so on. And there was a good market, the city was growing, and there was need for cement and road materials and everything else, building materials. So they did that.
Do you think the limestone mining that was going on here influences the kind of architecture you see here, especially in our older buildings?
Absolutely. The one thing about architecture is that you always try to look at the local resource. If it was available locally, naturally you would use that. So that was a very logical way for them to use that. So when they started to extract the limestone, they made their money, they sold it, and that's it, you know. And then sometime in the middle of the last century, sometime in the 50s, there were some business entrepreneurs who looked at all the underground space, abandoned underground space in the area. And the city was growing, there was need for more space. So, hey, here is a resource that is a problem for us to maintain. Water is getting into it and it's abandoned. And we talked about crimes and all that kind of thing happening. See, well, why not we convert it into usable space?
And you're talking about the 50s now?
Right.
Something that I was wondering about, and maybe Monroe can weigh in on this. This is maybe an arbitrary question, but the Cold War would have been going on at that time. And there was so much talk about fallout shelters and bomb shelters. Did anyone ever consider, did people see these limestone, these former mines as opportunities in that respect?
Right. There is a facility over at Atchison, Kansas, and they seriously considered using that as a shelter. In fact, if you look at the history of the underground space development in the area, by that I mean converting the abandoned mine into useful spaces, Atchison was the first abandoned mine, which was owned by a person, George Kerford. And during the Second World War, the government wanted to have a place for storage of perishable food. So he leased that facility to them for, I think, $200,000 per year back in those days during the Second World War. And federal government then spent $2 million immediately to put a refrigeration system. And they had perishable foods, milk, dairy products, fruits, you name it, everything, just as a war effort that we should have a reserve of food.
Wow.
And later on, that place also was considered as a shelter for nuclear fallout.
That's incredible. And I hear that there was a time when there was some NASA activity down there.
Well, that is what was mentioned by my colleague here, Art Branson, whose underground space is right off I-435 near Truman exit. He had a contract from NASA. He was in the business of manufacturing navigational equipment. So when the space program got on board or got going, he got a contract from them to devise some specialized navigational system that could be used in the space. And in order to calibrate those instruments, he wanted to have a perfect environment where there won't be any influence of the outside conditions. And that he found in the underground space. So that's where he put up his factory.
We'd love to hear from our listeners, too. Have you been in the tunnels or mines underground? Tell us about it. Call 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. That number again is 816-235-2888. And Monroe, we don't just have mines. There are other components of our underground city. There are tunnels that used to have purposes and now...
Yes, Kansas City has gone underground for a lot of purposes. I'm really not sure about the nefarious purposes, but we know that straight up in the late 1880s, when the place was in its first major economic boom, there was a group of investors from St. Louis who wanted to build an elevated railroad across the West Bottoms to connect Union Depot with Kansas City, Kansas, or what would become Kansas City, Kansas. And then the question became, well, how are we going to get these cars and these passengers up that big hill to downtown? They hired a guy named Robert Gillum, who'd already developed some cable car systems in Kansas City, and he said the best way down there from the top of the hill is to go by way of a tunnel. And so at 8th Street, at Washington Street, 8th and Washington, there started a tunnel. I believe it had brick inside lining it, and it went down to what is now – there's now a highway down there. It's very difficult to find the old portal of the streetcar line down there.
But you can find it?
You can find it. In fact, if you know the right people at DST, I am told, you can even get a guided tour sometimes of the tunnel. Now, there was another tunnel. In the early 1900s, this tunnel, which had about an 7 or 8% grade, I think, and was a little bit tough for streetcars to motor up, was lowered to about a 5% grade to make it, you know, life easier on them. By then, these are electric cars and just using traction. They don't have a cable or anything to grab onto. And that got people up to the top and down to the bottom. And a lot of Kansas Cityans who were alive in that period still remember the old tunnel. Now, they'll remember it exiting at Broadway, which by going farther east with that eastern exit gave it that lower grade. But they'll remember it. They'll remember it was cool in there all of a sudden on a summer day. These unair-conditioned streetcars would be rolling along in the heat. You go inside, it's shady, it's cool. It also dripped water and things. But there's a lot of people who are at least my age, I think, and older, who'll remember that.
And does anyone still go in that tunnel?
Both those tunnels, I think, are accessible by from the people at DSC if you're nice to them or you've heard about a tour. And there were other tunnels in Kansas City, too. There's one that goes under the Missouri River. In fact, that carries water from the treatment plant under the Missouri River to downtown Kansas City. It was reboarded a few years ago, but it was originally built in the late 1920s by men with shovels and pickaxes and dynamite. Now they've got big monster tools that do that. But it goes 300-plus feet under, I believe, to get under the river.
This whole pickaxes and dynamite picture you're painting for me sounds incredibly dangerous. Was this a treacherous line of work?
Oh, yes.
Very hazardous, yeah.
Tell us about how it works creating a tunnel underneath a river, something, you know, that's a lot of water.
Well, the first thing we have to do nowadays, of course, technology has improved. We have got a specialized machine. We call it tunnel boring machine that you can think of it as just as a big horizontal drilling machine. You know, instead of going vertical, it goes horizontal. And it has got complete shielding over it. And many times that works if there's not too much water. If there's too much water, then you have a system of dewatering the tunnel, meaning that you have a heavy-duty pumps to take the water out and create a dry environment. And then you do it in sections. You do it, maybe you do about 8 feet or 10 feet excavation. You put support right after that. And that's how you progress in the steps until you bore through the entire length of the tunnel.
Have these underground spaces that we have in Kansas City, have they shaped anything with regard to our city above ground, what you see as the city that you travel through every day, or has it more shaped our imaginations?
To me, it's an imagination thing, although, of course, it's real. But when you're walking around and thinking, gosh, under me is not just dirt. There's life. There's storage. There's people at work doing things, the most amazing stuff down there. It's imaginative.
We're going to take a short break. Russ, Monroe, Syed, can you stick with us?
Sure. Thank you.
Central Standard will be right back. We're back. Central Standard today is a historical exploration of the city underneath our city, in the mines, the caves, the tunnels. I want to talk about that word cave in just a second, but if you've been down there or have a question about it, give us a call at 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. The number again is 816-235-2888. Our guests are Monroe Dodd, he's our resident historian here at Central Standard, and Syed Hassan, a professor of geosciences at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so I do want to talk about terminology. I hear, Professor Hassan, that you don't like people to say caves.
Exactly. I think the word cave should be reserved for any natural opening in the rock. And these are not natural. These are man-made. So they are more like mine. So that is the difference, really. It's not natural. It's man-made. So we should use the word mine. Abandoned mines and stuff like that, but not a cave.
In mining communities, you do sometimes hear news about things like sinkholes. Have we had sinkhole issues here?
Right. Sinkhole is the result of a process which we call subsidence. What happens is that the ground suddenly drops down, and then it leaves behind a depression, which is a sinkhole. Sometimes these sinkholes, they get filled with water. We have a lake there. But we don't have that kind of sinkholes here, the traditional or the conventional sinkholes. What we have here is the expression of the collapse of the roof of the mine. Now, this mining is a very, very delicate and critical operation. You have to make sure that you're not going to take too much of the rock from the roof of the mine, because if you do that and you're not leaving behind sufficient rock cover between the roof and the surface, then you have the chance of the what we call cave in, the roof dropping down into the floor of the mine, and that will progress upward, and then you will have a basin or a what we call a sinkhole on the surface. It has happened in the area. I investigated some of them in the 80s. Luckily, nobody was killed, but two homes were badly damaged, and that happened up in the Independence area in the old mines there.
So where are the prominent locations for these underground areas, these mines?
County-wise, most of them are in Jackson County. City-wise, we have got one of the largest operations, which is still actively mining the limestone, is the Subcropolis that you mentioned in the beginning. It is the operation that was owned by the Hunt Lamar, which is the owner of that team here. And it has changed names, but now it is called Subcropolis. That is still actively mining. They have gone, I think, more than a mile inside the bluff. And right now, I think they are past the world of fun and ocean of fun. They are progressing north in that direction. And it's a great operation. They have got some of the unique facilities located underground, including the U.S. Postal Service Philatelic Bureau, where any new stamp or any stamp for the collection is stored there. And anybody from the world can order it, and the order is processed there and shipped out. I have been there several times, and they've got a great operation there.
And, Monroe, there are historic archives there, too, government archives.
We have a Bureau of the National Archives Administration here in Kansas City. And one of their charges is to store lots of interesting stuff. And another one of their charges is to store lots of mundane stuff that the government produces. I think the mundane outnumbers the interesting. And so they have used caves in the Lee's Summit area and definitely in the Lenexa area, some of the newer caves out near 95th Street.
We have got a full switchboard. So I'm going to turn to our callers. We're going to hear what David in Lenexa has to say. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call and kind of answered one of my questions about the Maritex cave complex out near where I am. I see it all the time and just didn't know anything about it other than there was a sign for the National Archives there. And then another comment was I had a friend in high school whose dad owned some land out here and had old abandoned limestone mines on it that we went in several times and one time got lost in for 4 or 5 hours.
Is this a childhood pastime?
Exploring is still a pastime for me, but yeah, now the property is developed on and there's houses and a golf course there. But it was a lot of fun going in there, and sometimes you'd find old abandoned equipment and tools and stuff. It was interesting. So
down in that cave, you should be able to find what's left of the emergency room in Dallas, where President Kennedy lay after he was shot by Lee Harvey Oswald in 1963. When the Parkland Memorial Hospital, where the Dallas Hospital District broke the stuff up and was going to change Parkland, apparently in the 1970s, they decided they would try to turn this over to somebody. Smithsonian Institution didn't want it. The John F. Kennedy Library didn't want it. But the National Archives said, we'll take it. And it stayed in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for years until, I think, 2007, when they needed to move it somewhere. And there was this cave space in Lenexa that was inexpensive and a good place to store it. And so it's there. All medical equipment, the gurney, apparently the one on which he lay.
That's
some
incredible.
Plaster from the walls. And you can't see it. I can't see it either. It is because of what is obviously, on some people's part, a morbid curiosity. And for the sensitivity to the remaining members of the family and the country, it's not open for public viewing.
Why do they need to preserve it?
That's a good question. I think this is one of those cases of it's because it's there. There are questions saying, isn't that weird? But I guess you could say, well, it doesn't do any harm to keep it as long as it's not too expensive. And someday somebody might want to see it. So you err on the side of preservation.
Let's talk to David in Stillwell, Kansas. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I've got a story to share with involving the underground. When I was in college down in Missouri Southern, our pole vault coach for track and field approached us athletes saying that he found a place to pole vault indoor. We didn't have an indoor facility back in the late 90s when I was there. So he drove us to a nearby town in Carthage, and they had an underground there. And it was just a big cave like you have been describing. And the ceiling there was about 18 feet high. Right. And back then I was pole vaulting about 16 foot high. And so it gave me about a 2 foot clearance before I would hit my head. But we set up the pits, the pole vault mats, and the runway, and be vaulting next to semi-trucks driving by, unloading their supplies and the diesel exhaust, I remember. And it was quite the experience then.
Did you see the tennis court there? They had a tennis courts also there.
Yeah.
At the Carthage mine, yeah. That's a great facility, yeah.
Syed, I have a question about this, because the reason that they're doing this dangerous indoor pole vaulting is because it's so cold in the winter above ground, but that underground in these mines, the temperature remains a pretty consistent,
that's
I think
right.
It's like
62. 60, 64 degrees throughout the year. You may have 100 degrees up on the surface in the summertime or below freezing in the wintertime. You go inside the mine, the temperature stays around the 60, 64-degree range. And that's
Can you explain that scientifically?
Oh, yes. The rocks are a great insulator. They are natural insulator. So the heat cannot get in or the cold cannot penetrate beyond a few feet. So once you're deep inside, the natural earth temperature prevails. That's as simple as that.
That's so fascinating.
And that is one reason why the business like to locate underground, because the utility bill is very low. They don't have to spend too much money on heating and cooling.
Along those same lines, Linda called in. She wasn't able to stay, but she wanted us to say that the biggest effect in her mind on the environment is that you don't have nearly as much warehousing taking up landscape. Could be up to millions of square feet. Could you address that?
I think she is talking about the fact that warehousing usually takes a lot of space. If you put those facilities above the ground, of course, it's not one of the best places to put those kind of warehouses. And underground is the best option. So I think, in Kansas City, we have got hundreds of acres of developed underground spaces. In terms of the sheer square footage, you're talking about several tens of millions of square foot that is available.
Let's turn now to Sean in Grandview. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. What can you share?
Oh, I just want to say I worked on that Trans-Missouri River Tunnel you guys were talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, talk about it. Tell us what that was like.
Well, they had a VBM, which did the actual hole. They got a downshaft and an upshaft. The downshaft was 365 feet, and they had a brine plant on it at first for about 3 months, freezing the ground because of the old river bottoms.
Yeah.
And then we was able to drill down, pour concrete, and then go down the bottom and start drilling with the tunnel boring machine. And he hit all kinds of stuff, oil, gas, a lot of water, but it was interesting.
Was it rock under there or just soil they were going through?
It was all rock.
All rock.
Yeah, and we had sensors set up for methane, and they had what they called vent shafts, which actually pumped air down there, and that was supposed to be your escape route out, but I don't believe that.
You don't think you would have gotten out that way?
I think if you got trapped in there, you'd have been between them or you'd had a heck of a time waiting for air to get down there.
Oh, man. Well, we're glad that didn't happen to you, Sean. Thanks so much for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye.
And now I want to go over to talk to Gregor. He is calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Gregor.
Hi. Say, I wanted to know, perhaps you know about this. At 55th and Ward Parkway on the northeast corner, are the Ward Bingham houses, and they date back to the 1850s or possibly beyond. Allegedly, there is a tunnel that is at the end of the Underground Railway, And supposedly it goes into over underneath Ward Parkway and into Kansas, which was a free territory. So the slaves could, at the end of the Underground Railway, get into Kansas. Do you know about this tunnel? Have you seen it? I've heard all these urban legends about it, but I wondered what the truth is.
I have not heard anything about that location, but I do know that there was an underground tunnel in the Quindaro district in Kansas City, Kansas.
Yeah, made famous by the John Brown exploits.
Yeah, but I don't know if the tunnel was dug up that far. I think it's a legend, perhaps.
I've heard the urban legends, too. I think perhaps the Underground Railway was unfortunately named. People want it to be underground. And what it meant was it was underground from the prying eyes of pro-slavers.
Underground in the metaphorical
yes.
sense.
Yes, right.
Let's talk to Ben in Kansas City. Hi, Ben.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How about you?
I'm doing great. Well, I've lived in Kansas City my entire life, and I guess, you know, I guess the underground for some people is kind of mysterious, but for me it's always kind of been just kind of a given, and it's kind of tied to commerce more than anything. When, you know, when I was a kid, I always heard about that there were tunnels under a lot of buildings in downtown Kansas City along Broadway, and I've seen those with my own eyes, and during Prohibition, they would bring, you know, the booze in, and then they could take it literally down the block, underground, to other speakeasies. And so that was used for commerce back in those days. And a lot of those tunnels under those buildings still exist.
I wonder if, go on.
Well, I also knew there were some caves outside of what would have been, you know, traditional Kansas City, Missouri city limits. And during Prohibition as well, they're used to actually, and I'm going to use the term cave, because they were caves, and people would have speakeasies in those caves. That were outside the city limits, number one. And number two, obviously, you know, you wouldn't be detected.
Well, I want to get Monroe to either corroborate this idea or...
It's interesting the role that alcohol and its use have played in things underground. Between the Hotel Baltimore and the Willis Wood Theater across the street around the turn of the century, there was a tunnel. You could leave the hotel, go down, have a highball, walk across the street, see a play if you wanted. See a play, and if you wanted, you could even leave the play early and go back and drink at the bar. Up in Weston, Missouri, underneath O'Malley's Pub, you can go down level after level after level, and some of us even get a little claustrophobic doing it from some caves that were built in, well, some underground mines that were dug out in the 1840s by a German brewer. And now the place brews beer again, but also you can go way underground to the things he dug way back.
Let's talk to Florence in Kansas City, Kansas. Hello, Florence.
Yes, interesting program. I was calling to ask the visitor, who owns all of this property underground? Do they pay taxes on it, the owners?
Yeah, what is the ownership of this land? Is it public? Is it...
Well,
I mean, obviously, Subtropolis is not.
Subtropolis was assembled when Lamar Hunt invaded Kansas City with his chiefs and Worlds of Fun and the underground thing. And yeah, that's privately owned. The inland storage area out in Kansas City, Kansas, was invented by a commercial guy who saw an opportunity to store stuff. I think most of these are privately owned.
Most of them, yes. The Dean Machinery and Tool Company on 31st and Southwest Traffic Way, that is owned by Lester Dean. So, yeah, I think all of them perhaps are owned by private people. City doesn't own anything. The Atchison Mine, for one time, it was owned by the Department of Defense. But now it is privatized again. They have sold it recently, and it is in a private ownership now.
And as for taxation, I don't know the answer to that.
A question for another day, perhaps. That's it for today's conversation about Kansas City's underground labyrinths. Thanks so much for swinging by, Monroe Dodd.
Thank you.
That was Central Standard's resident historian Monroe Dodd, who joins us regularly on this show, and Syed Hassan of the School of Geosciences at UMKC. Thanks for being here today. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. Can I just add one last comment?
Quickly.
In Kansas City, we are very fortunate. We are number one in the world, recognized leader in the use of underground space. And for every Kansas Cityan, we have to be very proud of what we have. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Tune in tomorrow to meet the third high school senior we'll be following this year as part of our Class of 2015 series. We'll also check in with some Kansas City musicians enjoying the annual Bluegrass Bluegrass Festival in Winfield, Kansas. Our show is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Gina Kaufman. The standard's been set. Stick around for Up to Date. Next.